Solutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000 members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. For the first time in the nation's history, the Colombian people have elected a leftist to the presidency. Gustavo Petro defeated far-right populist Rodolfo Hernandez. The former guerrilla has pledged to challenge economic inequality and fight climate change by transforming the country's energy system. What does this victory mean for socialism in Latin America? DSA National Political Committee member Marvin Gonzalez joins us to discuss that and much more. Here in New York City, the City Council and Mayor Adams passed a new budget last week that funnels money to private creditors and the cops while cutting funding for education and other social services. We'll hear from Kay Gabriel on why this budget is an attack on the working class and how NYC DSA plans to build a movement to fight back. But first, the headlines.
What's up, New York City? This is Amy Wilson with your headlines for today, Wednesday, June 22nd. In local news, tenant groups and advocates have pushed the Rent Guidelines Board to keep rents flat for rent-stabilized apartments ahead of a vote yesterday, Tuesday, June 21st. This effort comes after unstabilized rental units have recently seen increases into the hundreds of dollars. Mayor Eric Adams euphemized over $200 million in cuts to schools in this year's budget by claiming they were not actually cuts, but rather that he had, quote, reallocated the money based on student population, end quote. City and State misreported that the six New York City Council members who voted against the city's budget for fiscal year 2023 saw programs in their communities defunded in retribution, causing a firestorm of further criticism against Mayor Adams and Speaker Adrian Adams' budget. The six council members who voted no ultimately lost recognition for their projects, which are still funded in the budget. The City Parks Department canceled several of its summer swim safety programs, citing a national lifeguard shortage. City Hall has denied qualified first responders from working as lifeguards amid the shortage, citing financial belt tightening and a rule from 1987 that restricts dual employment of city employees. The city is exploring switching to lower-cost health plans that may cut services or raise premiums for hundreds of thousands of city employees, retirees, and their dependents. Climate activists have criticized the Adams administration implementation of Local Law 97, a landmark climate law passed in 2019. The city has just 6 months to issue new rules and regulations to building owners, a task that activists say requires much more funding than what was provided in the latest budget. The NAACP and lobbyists for a voting machine manufacturer teamed up to kill a bill aimed at so-called election security. The bill easily passed the New York State Senate and seemed to have majority support in the state assembly, but the chair of the Election Law Committee, Assemblymember Latrice Walker, did not bring it to a vote. New Jersey Transit shut down train service on June 18th in response to a sick-out by the Train Engineers Union. The Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen is expected to release a statement this week. The chair of the Brooklyn Democratic Party is taking the power to hire poll workers away from district leaders who oppose her and giving it instead to loyalists running in primaries. Such jobs, which have traditionally been filled by district leaders, have become more lucrative as New York State has expanded early voting and has two Democratic primaries this year. And in elections news, early voting has begun in the June Democratic primary, which has statewide and assembly races on the ballot. Governor Kathy Hochul, New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams, and Congressmember Tom Suozzi of Long Island met for the last gubernatorial debate ahead of the Democratic primary this month. Jonathan Soto, a progressive state assembly candidate with the backing of the Working Families Party and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, returned a donation from a Wall Street executive, even as an independent expenditure committee supported by the executive continues to support Soto. Soto's opponent, incumbent Democratic Assemblymember Michael Benedetto, released a string of videos objecting to Soto's characterization of him as a, quote, Trump Democrat. For Revolutions Per Minute, I'm Amy Wilson. Now let's go back to the studio for another great show.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethornnyc.substack.com. Hey, how's it going, Marvin? Thank you so much for joining us again on Revolutions Per Minute. I think we might have Marvin muted for a sec.
Am I muted?
No, I can hear you.
Hey, how's it going? Sorry about that.
No worries. All right. Well, thank you for being back on the show. We appreciate it. And just want to get started by asking you, who is Gustavo Petro? What is his political platform? And how does his victory represent a culmination of the struggle against neoliberalism in the streets in Colombia?
You know, this is such an interesting moment. You know, Gustavo Petro was a current senator. He's been a front runner for president before. He's ran three times, you know, the third time's a charm. You know, he's a former rebel. He was a member. He was radicalized, of the kind of the Marxist, like urban guerrilla group, M19. When he was 17, he spent time in jail as a result of that kind of participation in that activity. M19 demobilized in the 80s, so it's, you know, it's been a while, but he definitely comes from a very militant left, from a very militant left origin. So this is a really interesting situation. I would say that, you know, Gustavo Petro is running on a coalition. So this is not Pacto Histórico, which is the coalition that he ran on, and then he's had that part of Congress, his Congress will serve on, which is a plurality and not a majority of the Congress. It's formed from a diverse groupings of parties, you know, leftist, communist, green parties. It's a very diverse coalition. His party specifically is called Humane Colombia. And it'll be interesting to see how he can both develop, you know, that party as well as the coalition. So this is really, I think, a really energizing victory. It means a lot, right? Because Colombia is historically the U.S.'s strongest ally in Latin America, like its biggest trade partner. While most of the region trades with China, like most exports go to the U.S. from Colombia. And most importantly, which I think will be the biggest impact, is the way that Petro decides to do kind of defense and coordinating defense with the U.S. Right? It's not unfair to say that Colombia, in a lot of ways, has been a client, you know, state of the United States, and that has often done like the military doing of the U.S. in the region. So this shape up, I think, is really, really historic. This is, you know, the first leftist president in Colombia's existence.
Yeah, so you have this massive, broad-based coalition that has emerged to challenge the powers that be in Colombia. And I think you started to hit on this a little bit, but who is the ruling class of Colombia, and why have they had so much success defeating electoral challenges to their power until now?
You know, that's a difficult question. Colombia, like a lot of the Latin American countries for a long time, as a result of, you know, the Monroe Doctrine and then the supposed good neighbor policy, right? was a client state of the U.S. A lot of it's you know, pretty much every Latin American country has had a U.S.-backed dictator in its history, and the U.S. and then and Colombia is no different. And as a result of like U.S. meddling, like we can go on and on. They have a really, really interesting history, but essentially, you know, Colombia has been in a kind of low intensity and sometimes high intensity civil war for 60 years. And as a result, leftist politics have been really stigmatized in Colombia amongst like voting people, right? A lot of the leftists were caught up in the armed struggle, like I said, M19, but you also have, you know, the FARC, which demobilized a few years back. And you also have the EZLN, right? So, which is still active, and Petro has, you know, vowed to try to do a peace agreement. But as a result, you don't see a lot of leftist mobilization in the electoral terrain. The Colombian ruling class has really benefited from this. And it's not also unfair to say that there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of, you know, participation in the narcotics trade. So there's a lot of fossil fuel, business happening there. So this presents a really big shake or potential shakeup with the Colombian ruling class.
Yeah, as you're saying, and I think Petro has been discussing this, where he plans to target the sort of, as he describes it, the narco-feudal ruling class as it exists in Colombia, as well as transform the energy system, which would take away power from the fossil fuel giants that exist in Colombia. So that's kind of a dual strategy. And as you also have been mentioning, Colombia is a client state of the United States and its strongest ally in the region. And I think you've been hitting on this question throughout the interview so far, but in what ways is Petro's election a challenge to U.S. imperialism in the region?
Petro has outright stated that he's going to break with the defense policies of his predecessors, that he's going to normalize relationships with Venezuela. He's going to you know, try to move the economy away from fossil fuel. In a lot of ways, Colombia, like a lot of places, you know, Venezuela, its neighbor to the east, has often been a kind of monocrop exporting, you know, economy, and that being fuel. So what Pacto Histórico has really sold itself on has not really been like really big social democratic or democratic socialist policies, right? There's definitely a very big leftist element to this coalition, but the rhetorically, the way that it's really kind of sold itself is kind of a modernization of Colombia's economy, and then kind of a developmental approach to its economy, to diversify its economy away from, you know, from narcotics, to diversify its away from fossil fuels. That kind of economic security, I think, in itself is a challenge to U.S. imperialism that for a long time has encouraged this type of, you know, one thing centered economies.
Yeah, when imperial relations are so dependent on, as you're saying, this sort of extractive relationship where you're dominating commodity trade that is oriented around a single commodity. I mean, this dates back to the time of slavery with cotton production, sugar production, or the way, if we could talk about imperialism in Africa, the way rubber or nowadays like lithium is extracted. It's this extractive relationship, and what Petro is planning to do, and I think in alliance with other leaders in the region, is to challenge this extractive relationship. And I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we're talking about Petro's election in Colombia, and then later we'll be discussing the New York City budget with Kay Gabriel. And so, Marvin, again, this is something that we've been hitting on in certain terms, but I think is a key question here is What does Petro's victory mean for socialism in Latin America?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I also want to say, you know, if we're talking about extraction, we also have to talk about Francia Marquez, right? You know, his vice president, the first, you know, black vice president in Colombia. She's been a former housekeeper. You know, she went and she's been an activist who's been really active in indigenous communities and specifically against like extractivist policies. So when we're talking about kind of the shift in environmental policies here, it's really important to bring up Francia Marquez. To answer your question, you know, it's honestly too early to tell. I do want to temper kind of excitement. Pacto Histórico has not won a majority in Congress, right? They've won a plurality, but they've not won a majority. There's going to be a lot of pressure, as we know, with like coming from the imperialist, you know, core up north. It was a kind of a slight majority. I think he won by 50.5%, right? So this is both historic, but we also have to kind of, I think we should temper what we can expect from a lot of this government. So it's really too early to tell how this will transform Colombian society. I think the question really is, can Pacto Histórico as a coalition, you know, form the type of organization that can have lasting roots in Colombian society and expand beyond its base. That's going to be really important to accomplish a lot of its goals. But right off the back, I think it kind of puts the idea that there's a pink tide resurgence. It gives that idea kind of credibility, you know, and there's been people saying this from Chile to AMLO's kind of turn a little bit more to the left. So I think having the U.S.'s, you know, major ally, which has historically been right-wing governments, become a popular leftist, pro-indigenous, anti-extractivist government, I think that that's really going to seed good conditions for leftists across Latin America to begin experimenting with new political forms. I don't want to overstate this, you know, because a lot of the earlier pink tide was predicated on a commodity boom. Venezuela does not have, you know, the resources that it did. So I both am excited and I also want to be kind of a little bit realistic.
Yeah, that while this is an incredibly encouraging development, the fact that a leftist has been elected in Colombia and that this is part of a larger shift electorally where we're seeing this new constitution being forged in Chile with the elections last year in Peru and the elections in Chile as well, and what's happening in places like Argentina that and potentially in Brazil with Lula on the ballot once again, that there are a lot of challenges lay ahead. The imperial power of the United States still exists and is still out there. The local ruling classes in these countries, the narco and fossil fuel and land-owning classes in Colombia, and you can stretch the commodity owners all across South America and Latin America as a whole, still hold sway and power. And it's going to be a fight and a challenge. But I think what this is encouraging on a lot of levels is that you could see a potential alliance formed between these governments as they exist. Like, as you mentioned earlier, the normalizing of relations with Venezuela and potential blocks that can be forged and deals that can be made between leftist governments in Latin America. And before you go, I just want to ask you, what can socialists in the United States learn from the recent successes of left-wing electoral campaigns in Latin America?
I think that the biggest, you know, I'm a member of the International Committee, and I've been working on studying a lot of the Latin American leftist movements. And I think that the number one thing that I see across the board is that these movements are not hollow movements, right? They're not just like big mobilizations to get a certain candidate to over the line, right, to get people to vote for them on election day. Like these are movements with real organizations. They have real links to working class communities. and real working class fights like extractivism, labor unions, the peasant movement. So I think what I see the lesson here is that electoral politics is incredibly important part of the leftist movement, but it needs to kind of be anchored in a very kind of organized and popular movement that organizes the class more broadly.
Yeah, that you have to forge relationships from the ground up, and that you have this political program and politicians that are pushing forward, but you can't do it without labor unions, without tenants unions, without a broader organized movement that's able to strike back at the workplace and beyond and hit the streets and demonstrate working class power.
Right. Absolutely. It's not just about, you know, to say it in kind of simple terms that I know a lot of socialists and organizers hear all the time in the U.S., right? Like, mobilization is not enough. We actually need to organize.
Well, that's a great point to end on. And I just want to give you a chance. Is there any way, anything you want to highlight that's that the international community is up to, that you want listeners to get to know about, or if they can get involved in any of the work that's going on?
Yeah, the DSA International Committee is a very big committee. It has over 700 general members. You can go to look up DSA IC, and you can look up how to join. I would say that, you know, we really want to kind of, we had a member embedded within the Progressive International delegation in March, and we really want to continue to do this type of like on the ground relationship building, electoral observation, and kind of linkages with these parties. In order to do that, we do need money. So if you go to the DSA IC website, there is a link that says donate, and you know, if you have a little bit of cash, just give us some money, and the link to that is international.dsausa.org.
Well, thank you for sharing that with our listeners, and thank you so much for joining us, Marvin. It was really great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Have a good one. All right. And well, Marvin was talking about money for the DSA International Committee. I'm going to talk about money for this station, because in order to have programs like Revolutions Per Minute on the airwaves, WBAI needs money. We were hearing about it from earlier in the hour. Max was discussing this. We're in the midst of our Tower Fund campaign, and we need our listeners to go to towerfund.wbai.org to give a donation. If you have a little bit of money, that's great. If you have a lot of money, that's really great. I mean, I know that it's tough times. There's inflation. There's an economic crisis that's happening, pending recession. But we're hoping that we can keep this station on the airwaves, because we're going to need a station that talks about things from an international perspective, from labor's perspective, from the perspective of workers struggling at the point of production, struggling against price hikes. We need a perspective that highlights that it's profiteering and the power of American corporations and like the oil companies, for instance, that is really driving the price of gas to go up. We need to be sharing that and getting that on the airwaves. In order to do that, we need to keep a station like WBAI on the airwaves. So to do that, you can go to WBAI.org, or you can go to towerfund.wbai.org, or call 212-209-2950. Again, that number is 212-209-2950. And just thinking about this from a historical perspective and why something like WBAI is so important is that in moments like this, and as a historian, I always like to, you know, hit the archives and figure out like what was happening in movements past, what were people saying was the strategies they were pursuing, what was the context they were fighting in. And something that is so great is that we have a long history in this country of labor newspapers and other forms of media that have been preserved over time. And WBAI itself has an incredibly great archive, a place where people can go and listen to interviews from the past and check out what people are saying in the 1960s when they were struggling the civil rights movement or fighting against the war in Vietnam, or more recently during the protests against the Iraq war, or what's been happening even more recently during Black Lives Matter, during the recent teacher strike wave with these these DSA elected officials coming to office. And that's what we want to do with this show, is that we want to be a source that people can go to now to learn about what's going on, to get involved in the organized fight and the struggle for socialism, where they can organize in their workplace, learn about how that's happening, whether that's at Starbucks, Amazon, or workplaces across the country. We also want to be a source for people to go back historically, and hopefully they'll be looking back at a movement with a lot of wins and a lot of gains, and maybe the whole thing. But what we're doing here, and that what's so crucial about having a station like BAI, is that we can create the sort of archive that people can go back and listen to, and that it's already being created, and it's being created every day. And we want to be connecting people with the great work that's going on with different perspectives. And so in order to keep this station alive, to keep it as a source of history, go to towerfund.wbai.org. It's towerfund.wbai.org, or you can call 212-209-2950. Again, that number is 212-209-50. And just to reiterate, the station is in dire need, and it's struggling. And without your help, and without the help of listeners, we could lose WBAI, which would be a real travesty for New York City. We're at a moment where, and we'll be discussing this in a little bit, the budget's being cut. There's cuts to education, and there's great shows on this station. They're talking about the issues of education, why we need to really change education policy, why we need to get more resources to education and not be cutting education. So I think we talk about that on this show, and we're going to be talking about that later today, and why education is so crucial. And what the station does is also it's a source of education. It's a way that people learn what's going on in their lives and not just get suffocated by information from corporate media. So please, if you've got the money and you really want to like save this show or other shows on the air that you really love, go to towerfund.wbai.org or call in 212-209-2950. Again, that number is 212-209-2950. So I want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we were just talking about Petro's election in Colombia and what that means for socialism in Latin America. And now we're just about to get rolling on our segment with Kay Gabriel on the New York City budget. So let's roll that clip. So we are here with returning RPM champion Kay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And so I'm sure our listeners have heard a decent amount about this very disappointing and destructive city budget. Can you break down for our listeners what the city budget actually is for this upcoming year, which departments received more funding, and what got cut?
Absolutely. So this is no question an austerity budget. It's a really bad budget. The biggest cut is a cut of $500 million to the Department of Education, and specifically for school funding. And I want to talk about specifically how that works in a second. So that's like a massive cut that like is specifically an attack on students and parents and families. Almost all of the schools that received over 30% cuts to their budget, and you heard that the number correctly, it's over, some schools are getting over 30% cuts to their budgets, are in Black and brown high poverty neighborhoods, right? So it's actually an attack on New York's working class. That's the biggest cut. But in order to actually understand what's going on with this budget, we also need to look at like who is getting more funding. And while there's been a lot of talk for good reason about police funding, I actually want to highlight that the biggest increase between the 22 and 23 budgets is to debt service. There is over, the city is spending over $1 billion more on debt service than it did last year. So what does this mean? This means that the city, instead of funding social programs like education that actually supports people, children, families, people's needs, the city is paying down its creditors. It's paying down, it's paying down debt. It's paying public money to banks and to the finance sector. So in a sense, this budget is actually like a transfer of wealth from the working class to enormously wealthy people, right? And that's like really what's happening in this budget. In addition to this, I think it's also important to note that funding for the Department of Corrections goes up. This is true even though 20 people have died in DOC custody since January 2021. Funding for the NYPD is going to be at its highest level ever. It's about $100 million more than it was last year. At $11.2 billion, it really is, you know, it's over 10% of the city budget is being spent on cops. So this is just like a heinous, heinous budget that absolutely should never have been voted through.
So at its core, this is a budget that is not just protecting property through investments in the Department of Corrections and the police, but also is further funneling money towards the wealthiest property owners in the city, the financial ruling class, while depriving students, teachers, parents, millions of people across the city of the investment in the social needs that people need on a daily basis in education. And it's absolutely outrageous. It's the opposite of what people have been fighting for in the streets and in the workplace for years. So I guess what's crucial here is like who fought against it. So can you tell us who voted against this budget? Why and were they retaliated against?
Yes. So six council members voted against the budget. Those are council members Caban, Aviles, Ose, Chiose, Sandy Nurse, Kristen Richardson Jordan, and Charles Barron. So six left council members. I just want to say, like, people have talked a lot about how this city council is the most progressive ever, you know, it's like so diverse, it's majority women. And, you know, like so many of those self-styled progressives voted in favor of a budget that defunds schools and funds police, which is the opposite of what they all ran on, right? So I think that there's a real degree of hypocrisy that demonstrates the limits of this like so-called progressivism. If like when the rubber hits the road, these again, like self-styled progressives who like borrow language from the left, but once they're in power, cozy up to the center for themselves or whatever it is, you know, can't actually develop a strategy to build power to win things that will change the lives and improve the lives of poor people in the city. And I think that that's like the real story there. And the other thing that I want to say about the no votes is like, you know, I'm not saying, I'm not saying that the people who voted no on the budget are like better people than the people who voted yes, because this is not a measure of like anybody's soul or like anybody's ethics. The people who voted no on the budget are people who have organic relationships to movement organizations. And that's not just DSA, although it includes Tiffany Caban and Alexis Aviles, who are DSA endorsed council members. All six of the people who voted no have organic relationships to movement organizations. They have intentionally built their power in order to carry forward the needs and desires and voices and strategies of those organizations. The council members who voted yes, some of them I think would like to have those relationships. They haven't necessarily developed them. Some of them have intentionally not developed them. Others simply, you know, again, are happy to use the language of the left, but do not have that kind of, have not developed, and in some cases have been actively hostile to developing that kind of like organic relationship with movement organization, which is why once they get into office, they function like every other politician, right? And I think this also like really demonstrates a limit to progressivism without actual, let's say, like socialist movement behind it and socialist organization behind it. The other thing I want to say about retaliation is the following. So the night of the budget vote, which was a week ago Monday, city and state noticed that that six council members who had not even yet voted no on the budget were not listed as having their projects funded. Like they had like the, like all council members have these like projects in their district that are funded by the speaker. And city and state ran this article that that showed, oh, these people who are expected no votes are not getting their projects funded. And then as the kind of the vote progressed, and in fact, these six members voted no, some more news came out, including the fact that the Astoria Boys and Girls Club, which had been expecting like a $150,000 grant from the city, wasn't getting that money. And this became a big, you know, a big, like, kind of a big scandal online. Like, AOC tweeted about it. And it really seemed to be the case that Speaker Adrian Adams was retaliating against the no votes. Now, the speaker says, oh, this was an oversight. It didn't happen. The people who voted no just didn't, they got their funding. They just didn't, they just weren't celebrated for their funding. It was just a publicity thing. I don't know if that's true or if she's just responding to pressure, right? But what is really important is for us to highlight first that this is just an extraordinarily undemocratic and in fact anti-democratic budget process where the speaker wields enormous power, including the power of punishing members who advocate for budgets that she doesn't agree with and who vote no on the handshake deal, right? On the budget that's being forced through. Right. And the other thing that I want to show is that being able to push, even though we couldn't win the budget that we wanted, being able to push back really forcefully on this retaliation to the point where the speaker was in this very defensive position, I think that that demonstrates nonetheless a lot of movement strength.
Yeah, there's enough movement strength out there to push back against this retaliation and to force the speaker into a defensive position and posturing and saying, no, this actually wasn't happening. I'm not doing this. So on one end, the movement has enough power in that sense, but not enough power to have a budget that actually reflects its demands, unfortunately. And as we've been discussing, massive education cuts while police spending, debt services, corrections increase. And this is devastating for the working class of New York and reflects a vision of public safety that is really connected to this media-induced hype about a crime wave rather than talking about actually fixing people's needs through investments in education, healthcare, housing. But I guess the question is how do we build a movement that is powerful enough to get to that city budget? So how does this budget reflect the balance of power in the city?
It's a great question. So one thing that I said before and I'll highlight again is the budget process is extraordinarily anti-democratic. The mayor wields the most power, then the speaker wields some power, individual council members as individuals can do almost nothing. They can sometimes fight against really bad things in the budget. Like there was supposed to be 500 new corrections officers. We got that removed, new stuff like this. Or they can fight for like little pet projects. But they have very little power as individuals and actual people have almost none, right? So this is like the balance of power in this city. The mayor holds almost all of the cards and Eric Adams is, you know, playing to his wealthy and powerful backers. Wall Street, boosters of charter schools, entrepreneurial capital, you know, all the people who funded his campaign to get him into office, right? So the question for us is really like, what do we do to build the power that we need in order to win the budget that we need? Right. And that, you know, I think is a very long process. Right. I don't think that can happen just by individual council members, even blocking together to negotiate a better deal. Although ultimately that does have to happen too. Right. And especially the individual council members who fought for their priorities as individuals need to realize that this is a dead end. They will never do anything more than getting like little bits of pork for their districts, right? They will not actually change the lives of deeply dispossessed people in this city. So in order, I mean, I this is why I kind of like want to put like this particular fight into a broader context. You know, I don't think we're going to win the budget that we need without like a much more organized and militant working class. So what does that look like? I think that looks like tenant unions, mass member, democratic, dues-funded tenant organization. That's like a really long-term project, right? But it's a very important project. I think that that means that, you know, it really means like going, changing the structures of organized labor in the city, which are so conservative and so in support of the kinds of, like UFT is a really good example, right? The United Federation of Teachers did not fight the bad education cuts until the very end of the process, right? And even UFT did not instruct members to vote no. Right. So doing the kind of thing, the kind of like organizing to change the power and vision and strategy of UFT is going to be so important for winning the kind of thing that we need. Right. And putting that together with movement electeds who are able to then help to channel some of that the sort of demands into really publicly available and clear, let's say, hard lines about what a budget needs to be. I think that when all those things come together, we will actually have the power that we need to really sort of force the conservative powers of like real estate capital and finance capital back in this process.
I'm glad you mentioned the UFT and how their strategy contrasts so starkly from what we see in Chicago with CTU, in Los Angeles with UTLA, and more broadly in a lot of teachers' unions across the city. We've seen strikes this year in Sacramento and Minneapolis, where these teachers are out there, they're hitting the picket line, they're fighting for the common good, they're striking for increased funding. They're not just asking for higher wages, but they're fighting for lower class sizes. They're fighting for more librarians, more nurses. And they're also fighting for immigrant rights and to keep ICE out of schools, to end the, in Chicago, the like not funding the Cops Academy and funding schools instead. There's more broad struggle that is taking place. And I think there's a lot to learn from those fights, because while that wasn't at the budget level, what was being decided is similar things that were decided in this budget fight, whether we're going to invest more into schools, into the resources for the working class, we're going to invest more into things that discipline the working class, like the police. And so I think there's a lot of lessons to be gained, lessons to be learned and things to be gained from really taking that in. But I think as you're talking about, it's more than just the fight on the labor side. We need to have movement politicians in the halls of government kind of echoing those calls. And that's what we've been doing with NYCDSA, but it's a gradual fight. It's a district by district. So what is NYC's DSA's vision for a people's budget, and how can organizers make that happen?
Also a great question. I mean, I think the one thing that I want to say is, you know, like the left in New York City right now, I think is very fragmented. I think, frankly, also people are like quite exhausted. I'm not despairing, but it's been a hard year. It was a hard year in the city. It was a hard year in Albany. And a lot of, let's say, like the activist layer of the left is pretty exhausted of its at this point. And also, really, this past year, nobody was able to like cobble together an actual strategic coalition that could push forward a vision for a people's budget. There were some really good efforts in that direction, but they weren't strong enough. The People's Plan, I just want to highlight what I think shows a lot of promise. The People's Plan is a kind of, let's say, it's an ad hoc coalition of other organizations, which has some real deep policy proposals for what a city for New York's working class would look like. And I think like that's exciting, right? But, you know, in order to put muscle behind that vision, we need like a real coalition between a number of different organizations with strength in many different places, many different neighborhoods, many different sources of power. And all of these people need to be aligned on vision and strategy. They need to give this process energy, which really didn't happen this year. A number of very prominent left organizations simply didn't focus on the city at all. They were so focused on Albany, they just neglected the city. Some of them didn't even know the budget fight was happening until it was over, right? And that, you know, I think that I think that there's like real limits to, let me just put it politely, there's real limits to like not knowing what's going on. So, you know, in order to turn this situation around, I think that people, wherever we are, who are committed to, you know, in this city that is like a working class city with an extraordinarily high union density, which is a majority city of tenants, which is a city of, you know, of immigrants, like with a really deep socialist and communist history, although one that is, you know, let's say still like in the process of coming to the surface after a period of historical dormancy, right? All these people drawing on all of these different sources of strength and power need to like come together into like a real coalition with a coherent vision and strategy to actually win the kinds of changes that we need to drastically improve the lives of poor and working people. And I think that work has to start now. Right. It has to start now for the 2024 budget. We actually can't sort of delay. Nobody is coming in to save us. We can't rely on like people in office who say that they have like good conscience or say that they're on our side. You know, there will not be like the kind of solidarity budget or the kind of people's budget, the kind of like actually massively redistributive budget that like, you know, gets us what we need, protects us from climate change, delivers the kind of healthcare that we need, delivers the education that we need without us fighting for it. And I think, again, that work has to start today.
Yeah, without an organized mass movement that's rooted in organizations that you've mentioned, tenant associations, unions, party organizations, and there's a deep history, as you referred to, of those organizations exerting their power in New York City, for example, in the 1930s, the massive power that the CPUSA and the union movement more broadly showed in, within New York City really changed the balance of power here. And then there's similar things that happened in the 1960s with Panthers, Young Lords. And so I think there's a long history to draw on. And that history dates back all the way to 1870s with massive riots. And so we could talk about this all day, but we're running out of time, and I just want to give you a chance for a final comment, and thank you once again for joining us on RPM.
I guess my final comment will be to shout out an action. I said unkind things about UFT before, which has not fought hard enough for smaller class sizes, although they say they support it and all kinds of other things. They are doing an action at City Hall on this Friday, the 24th. At 3 p.m. at City Hall, an action to protest the cuts to the school budget. So I strongly encourage people to turn out for that action and make your anger felt.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kay, and I'm sure you'll be back in Revolutions for Minutes soon.
Thank you so much.
People answer the call to public service in such different ways.
Mississippi Representative Ben.
Whoops.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we've been talking about Petro's election in Colombia, the first leftist to take the presidency there. And then we were just hearing from Kay on New York City's budget and the fight for a budget that actually funds working people instead of the institutions that discipline them. But we have around 5 minutes left in the show, so this time we'd love for you to call in and talk to us. You can give us a call at 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. But while we're waiting, I just wanted to mention there's a major strike happening in the UK right now, RMT, the union, striking the railroads there. And it's a really courageous action. And you've seen on TV, I believe his name is Mick Lynch. He's been talking back to the media in a hilarious way. He's been getting ridiculous questions from figures like Piers Morgan. And he's shown them to be the laughable supposed journalist that he actually is. And so it's been inspiring to see such leadership from a figure like Mick Lynch. It's been incredible to see those railroad workers out on the picket lines. And there's such a long history here in this country of railroad workers getting out on the picket lines and going on strike and fighting for decent wages and for much more than that. And I think it's something that is worth highlighting. I just also want to remind our listeners that the phone lines are open. It's 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. And Max, just let me know if we get any calls. Because I just want us to think about the railroad strikes. They highlight a couple of things. One, the way that working people, when they're united as a force, can really shape the foundations of society. Something that's been on my mind with these strikes out in the UK is the 1877 railroad strike here in the United States, when it started up in West Virginia and then it spread across the rail lines. It started at the Baltimore and Ohio rail line and then kind of spread across the country, where you had strikes, a general strike in St. Louis, where you had workers' councils being formed. Other workers were standing in solidarity out in strike with the railroad workers in St. Louis. Strike spread to Baltimore. It really was everywhere outside in Chicago. There was huge numbers of people in the streets supporting the strike, and it was really everywhere outside the Old South, where the states that had seceded and parts of New England. And what happened was, at first, the states called in the militia, and the militiamen, instead of going against the strikers, actually fraternized with them and began to form bonds and didn't put down the strike. But what happened next was the federal government called in the army to suppress the strike and ultimately crushed it. Now, so the workers were able to push back and defeat some of the wage cuts that spurred the strike, but they weren't able to take it to the next level, and some of the demands that were coming out of places like St. Louis at the time, when nationalization of the rail lines, and didn't happen. But this was a moment in which worker power was shown, and also the power of the state to crush worker power was also shown. And so you see that dialectic playing out in real time. But I think it shows that you need those moments where you're out and showing and demonstrating your full force. And that's how you can defend against wage cuts and fight for something more. You have to build this broader political movement that's in alliance with the workers' movement. And what we're seeing so frustratingly out in the UK is that the Labour Party is not really backing the strike in a vehement way. They're not standing on the picket lines. And so there was no political party really back then that was doing the same for the workers striking the rail lines of 1877. Of course, that is only one strike of many that occurred on the railways throughout the late 19th century. There's a famous one with the American Railroad Union, the Pullman strike, that kind of helped skyrocket Eugene Debs as a national figure, a labor leader. And in some ways, they were defeated in their strike, but Debs became a powerful force and kind of put socialism on the map in a lot of ways in the U.S. So I just want to check in, see if we have any callers.
We do not.
Oh,
but
right.
You're out of time, so.
Yeah, we're out of time anyway. So I just want to thank our listeners for joining us on Revolutions Per Minute. And we'll see you out on the streets, organizing your workplace, organizing your building. And you've been tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute, our listener sponsor, WBAI. And we will catch you next week, Wednesday at 9 p.m.